Bonjour, mes amis. Time to continue our journey on this, the Age Unsquared podcast, with the 28th episode on the docket. Yes, sirree, it's a sunny summer feeling day here as I broadcast out from deep within the prairie land of Canada. I fully realize that as the weather turns warm, though, and these lazy days of summer start wrapping their arms around us, listening to some guy drone on about finances, investment, and economics is not really high on your listening list. So, I'll be sure not to be that droning guy. But I can assure you that those are the topics at hand, and if we're serious about attaining financial independence so that any day can be warm and relatively lazy in the future, these are matters we cannot avoid nor ignore. But worry not, that is why I am here on this journey with you. If this is your first dive into our journey, why thank you so very much for joining us. I am your host and guide, Adrian Harsimu, but my friends call me Age. And for those of you that have been on this journey since step zero, I continue to extend my heartfelt appreciation for your support and tuning your good old ham radio to this podcast every week. But once again, I'm short on small talk, so let's cut to the chase and stop wasting precious seconds of my allotted 20 minutes. To kick things off for this episode, I'm going to share a brief piece out of a Tony Robbins book. Yes, your journey's guide is reading a Tony Robbins book. What are you going to do about it? No, but seriously, I have to admit, it's quite fascinating. And yes, I do realize that currently there is a BuzzFeed story out about Tony, and there are accusations of what might be happening behind the scenes at his events. But considering the source and the fact that I have no basis nor need to lay judgment on him, I will allow the proper authorities and channels to conduct whatever investigation they deem is necessary. In the meantime, I see no reason not to share valuable points he makes, especially since his raison d'etre is to help people live better and more inspired lives. It really fits into our motivations here for working towards financial independence, so why not include something from him? I don't see a reason to reveal the book I took this quote from, at least not just yet, as I have not completed reading it. But this image he floats really, really struck me, for reasons that I'll reveal in a few minutes after I read you this piece. So here it goes. I'd like to introduce you to a fellow named Walt. Walt is a good, decent human being who always tries to do the right thing. He has his life down to a science, everything in its proper place and in the correct order. Weekdays he rises at exactly 6:30, showers and shaves, gulps down some coffee, grabs his lunch pail filled with the requisite bologna sandwich and Twinkies, and runs out the door by 7:10 to spend 45 minutes in traffic. He arrives at his desk by 8 o'clock, where he sits down to do the same job he's been doing for the past 20 years. At 5 o'clock, he goes home, pops the top of a cold one, and grabs the TV remote control. An hour later, his wife comes home, and they decide whether to eat leftovers or throw a pizza in the microwave. After dinner, he watches the news, while his wife bathes their kid and puts him to bed. By no later than 9:30, he's back in the sack. He devotes his weekends to yard work, car maintenance, and sleeping in. Okay, now this is me age back here. That was the quote from Tony Robbins. Confused as to why I'm bringing this up in this podcast? Consider that Tony Robbins draws the connection a few lines further when he exemplifies Walt as, and I'm quoting here, someone who never suffers the depths of utter devastation or despondency, but also someone who never revels in the heights of passion and joy. Tony then mentions hearing a saying that the only difference between a rut and a grave is a few feet. And then he concludes the section by quoting Henry David Thoreau with this quote, "The mass of men lead lives of quiet desperation." Now, for anyone who has made the effort to listen to the pilot episode of Age Unsquared, that's episode zero for those searching for it, I think you've drawn the connection to why this quote from Tony's book resonates with me. For too long in my life, I tried to make life comfortable. As long as I experienced no pain, I thought I was happy, even if it was at the detriment of feeling true joy. But as the cliche saying goes, no pain, no gain, and that goes for more than just the physical challenges. It's why there are those among us who do find the upper echelons of happiness, because they are willing to experience controlled pain to achieve amplified joy. It's why I'm a proponent, at least generally speaking, of not envying those who have achieved mountains of success. We have no right to take that away from them, for we do not know, and most of us can't fathom, the amount of pain they were willing and able to suffer through to get there. What right do we have to take from them the spoils of their sacrifices? These people that many of us find so easy to criticize and to demand financial equalization from them are the same people that were willing to reach far beyond their comfort zones, knowing full well that in reaching and grasping their golden egg, they would be burned multiple times along the journey. But it's a journey they made, and it's a golden egg that they eventually did grasp. Now, this is a journey that I am on right now. It is one that I'm trying to break free from the monotony of having a life down to a science. That's boring and unfulfilling. Now, I don't normally like to use the word hope, but I do hope this segment has struck a chord with some of you, especially those of you young millennials and Gen Zs. Don't live a life that's so rigid that even your bathroom breaks are scheduled, all in the hopes of avoiding pain. It's not worth it. I speak from experience, not from a perch of moral high ground. Now, don't get me wrong, I didn't schedule my bathroom breaks, but it's a general experience that I did have in my past, so learn from it. But anyway, enough kumbaya for one episode. You're here for financial investment and economic matters, so let's get down to it. Okay, so for a financially tilted topic in this episode, I'm going to tip my hat to my business partner, Yaro, and read one of his blog posts from a couple of years back. He wrote a great piece about the real costs of owning a vehicle and shared his insights on the matter. So, for the next few minutes, while it is my voice you'll be hearing, it is Yaro's charm that will be just oozing through the content. Enjoy. The car, an asset most of us will have the majority of our adult life. We all remember the feeling of freedom, feeling like a big kid when we got our first car, whether we bought it ourselves or it was our parents' car. Either way, it was an awesome feeling. Cars are an asset we cherish and make use of throughout our working lives and into retirement. So here's a look at the costs associated with owning a car, as well as some comments on how we go by acquiring them. According to J.D. Power & Associates, data from 2014 shows that the average monthly car payment in Canada was $549 per month. What's even crazier is that the average financing term was 71 months. That's almost 6 years of paying off a car, just for the privilege to keep one on your driveway. Let's not forget the other costs of owning a car. Fuel, insurance, maintenance, these all add to that $549 cost every month. But you think 71 months is a long time? The trend is moving to 84 months. That's 7 years on average to pay off a depreciating asset. Oh, but wait. Some financing companies even offer 96-month terms. How quickly do you think your loan will be underwater in that case? Car finance companies have us by the throats. The idea is that after 6 to 8 years of car payments, you will need a new car and then will finance the purchase of that one. And on the story goes, more and more interest paid. Let's look at this from another perspective. Let's say the average working period of our lives is from 25 years of age to 65. That's 40 years. Now, let's say you have a car payment of $500 per month for the entire 40-year period. That's over $250,000 spent on cars in your working years. Some of you may think that that's not too crazy. Besides, we all need a car for work, life, and so on. Okay, here's another angle. What if instead of having a car payment for all those years, you took that $500 per month and invested it for the same time period and assume a not-too-crazy average annual return of 10%? At the end of that 40-year period, you would have, hold on to your hats, over $3.15 million. That is the power of compounding. That is the power of not having a car payment for your working life. That's just simple planning which can make you a multimillionaire by the time you retire. So why do people get new, expensive cars and pay these monthly payments? Because we have been convinced by car companies and marketing that it's the smart thing to do. But think about that. Is it smart for you or smart for the car financing companies? It is now considered the norm and even sophisticated to finance, or even better, lease a car than pay cash for one. Another issue to consider is how we go about purchasing cars. Some people argue that leasing is the way to go, that it's smarter. Leasing is the worst possible way to own a car. You might be better off renting a car than leasing. It's that bad. You're basically renting the car from the car maker for the term and then end up paying through the nose at the end for such terms as kilometers driven, terminating the lease, and so on. All of this surely leads you to ask, okay, then what are we supposed to do? Most of us need a car to get to and from work, to drive the family and such. Yes, our Western lifestyle is built around the car. Just look at how city planning works. Well, there are options. Firstly, consider, do you really need a new car? Yes, it has the unbelievable new car smell, but is it really worth it to pay all that money when the car starts losing its value significantly as soon as you drive off the lot? The depreciation continues in a big way for the first few years. So who can afford to buy a new car? The simple answer is the wealthy, with millions of dollars to their names. They can afford it because it will not dent their net worth all that much. But could an average 25-year-old afford to lose $5,000 or even $10,000 in the first year or two, just for that new car smell? If you think you can, then you will probably never be wealthy. Another option is to save up and buy your first car used, maybe a reliable little car for a couple of $1,000. Drive that for a few years while you keep earning and saving for your next car. Remember, you can always move up so your next purchase may be a used car in the $3,000 to $4,000 range, while also selling your first car for roughly the same you bought it for, as it doesn't depreciate as much as your newer cars do. Then you repeat the process again in a couple of years, buying a used car for $5,000 to $6,000 and selling your other car. The next cycle may be having you buy a $10,000 to $12,000 car, and you just keep building up from there. All the while, you're saving money but also have a way for your daily commute. When should you buy your first new car off the lot in cash? I think it would be most reasonable once your net wealth surpasses $1 million. Think that's crazy? I recently met a very wealthy fellow, worth in the tens of millions of dollars. He was driving a nice Audi A8, and I thought, there's a nice car. I've always been a fan of Audi, but never been able to afford them. I asked him how old the car was, and he said 3 years old. When I was surprised to hear that he had had it for that long, he said hell no, and that he had had it for only 1 year. He said he's not crazy to buy such a car new, as it loses $30,000 in the first 2 years. So there you have it. Even the multimillionaires are not buying new, so why are you? Okay, it's me age back now. Yarrow has produced a number of these pieces, so I don't know, maybe next time I'll get him to serenade you with his own voice recorded to this podcast as he reads you his insights on other matters. Now, moving along. In the previous episode, I made comments that, no matter how much I said otherwise, I'm sure some of you likely thought I was making this podcast political and defending the US president. Au contraire. So in this segment of the episode, I'm going to target a matter that President Trump has been very vocal and boastful about, and dismantle the hype. Do I have your attention now? Good, because I'm diving right into the topic of employment. A recent White House release boasts that the unemployment rate, sitting at 3.6% in April 2019, is the lowest it's been since December of 1969. Yes, that's almost 50 years that it has taken the unemployment rate to get back to such magical numbers. Of course, President Trump, being the bashful guy that he is, has absolutely no problem highlighting this feat, which of course has occurred under his watch. Well, for those of you fist-pumping and praising the president, get ready to have a massive hole poked into your fantasy world. And as for those searching for a solid reason to poke a hole in the president's narrative, get ready to have your minds blown. But first, this is not an issue that solely affects the US. It's one that is sold worldwide. But as with most things, the sales pitch is loudest coming from the US, so it's difficult not to latch onto their narrative as an example and sinking it. If you listen to any amount of political or economical news and talk, you've likely already heard someone attacking his unemployment number and explaining why it's nuts. You may even find yourself cheering and fist pumping, thrilled to hear more bad news for President Trump, even though you're not really sure what this media talking head is spouting. So I'm going to pull it all down to the very basics, because it is yet another important data point to understand and see clearly through. At its core, to calculate the unemployment rate, you need two numbers. You need the number of people unemployed and the number of people employed. Officially, the formula is the number of unemployed people divided by the labor force, which is the number of unemployed people plus the number of employed people. So let's look at an example. Say your town has 1,000 people living in it, all of whom are over 16 years of age. And that point is very important. Of those 1,000 people, 850 people are employed and 150 people are unemployed. Your town has a labor force of 1,000 people and an unemployment rate of 15%, because 150 divided by 1,000 is 15%. Simple enough, right? What's all the fuss about, you're asking? Well, as with many things in life, it's not as easy as that. Why? First of all, just because you aren't working doesn't necessarily mean you will be counted as part of the labor force. To be counted as unemployed, you must be 16 years of age or older and have been available to work full-time during the past 4 weeks. So think about it. If you were fired and immediately decided to go on a long vacation, you're not counted as unemployed, and thus you are not part of the labor force. Consequently, in that same 4 week time period, you had to have been actively searching for work. So again, if you were fired and just decided to laze around for weeks on end because you were all depressed and figured that finding another job was just pointless, you would not be counted as unemployed, and thus you would not be part of the labor force number. So back to the example with a town of 1,000 people over the age of 16. Now we'll say that 850 people continue to be employed, but only 50 are considered unemployed, as they're the only ones searching for work. That leaves 100 people that are either depressed, hopeless, on vacation, or something along those lines, but generally not looking for work. Now your town's unemployment rate suddenly drops to 5.56%. Why? Because your labor force is now 900, not 1,000. Because you have 100 people who are depressed, hopeless, on vacation, and so on, whom do not count towards the labor force number. Many of those of the 100 people in our example are called discouraged workers. These are people who may have looked for work in the past year, but not in the past 4 weeks. They would still like a full-time job, but they've hit a wall and feel like they're just too old or lack skills or face discrimination, so don't feel up to searching for a job. Yet again, these discouraged workers are withdrawn from the labor force number. With this foundational knowledge in your pocket, do some thought experiments. Think about who is not counted in Mr. Trump's boastful unemployment numbers. And to push the envelope, yet make things a bit clearer, a person could technically boast about a 0% unemployment rate. In our example, if you have your 850 town citizens whom are working, and the remaining 150 are discouraged or depressed or on vacation, suddenly your unemployment rate is 0%, because now your unemployment number is 0, and, last time I checked, 0 divided by 850, which is the total labor force, is an astonishing 0. I hope your next natural thought is towards those not working and not counted as unemployed. Is that not a problem, especially if they're so discouraged and depressed that they see no hope in looking for work? The point is that if these people were included in the unemployed number, unemployment rates would not be so low. This means that when you hear unemployment numbers, you should be digging deeper if they truly are of interest to you. And consider that time period of 4 weeks. That's not a very long time, so imagine how much information can change in that short span of time. On top of that, remember that the US has a population of about 327 million people, and this is as of July 2018. With about 262 million over the age of 16. How can all that unemployment information be properly collected so regularly to provide accurate statistics? Yes, I know, government is big and collects a lot of information. But even taking under consideration all the times they've had to correct and update so much of their employment information, I have to pause and wonder why much credence should be given to these numbers. My point here is that taking the unemployment rate at face value is dangerous. It does not give an accurate reading of the employment situation in any country, not just the US. But that puts a wrap on another leg of our unsquared journey. It's a journey that best grows with help from you, my friends. So if helping a humble guy like me grow our group is something you've been wanting to do for a while now, I have three easy requests for you to help our journey along. Firstly, if you aren't already, be sure to subscribe to the podcast at www.ageunsquare.com. And then with that step completed, posting a rating and review about the podcast will do our journey wonders too. And if that's already two check marks, the last step is the easiest and most impactful. Just be sure to share this podcast with three members of your inner circle of family and friends. Let them know the great things you're learning here. And you can also stay connected with me between episodes to get more age goodness. At present, I'm active under the @theoriginalage handle on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. So something for every generation. And if you're ready for a coffee or a tea instead, send me an email, adrian@agecorp.co, or message me on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram so we can connect and casually chat about your financial story. If financial independence is in your cards, my heart would be warm to welcome you into our extended financial family. As the closing music ushers me to the exit, Woda Pongyao, stay safe, keep your integrity, and see you at the pinnacle.